set you straight. And the Senate Special Committee on Oil and Gas to order. It is 9:06 a.m. Thursday, March 16th, 1989. Members present are Senator Pierce, Chair, Senator Adams, Senator Fisher, Senator Halford, Senator Kelly will be coming. We also have Representative Furness, and we welcome you, Mr. Furness. I want to just give everybody an idea of what our agenda is going to be for the next few days. This morning is our first hearing on Senate Bill 97. We will lead off with Senator Adams. It is his bill. We have allowed 30 minutes for each person this morning to do their testimony with at least 10 minutes for questioning. And following Senator Adams will be Mr. George Nelson, President of BP Exploration, and then at 10:20, the administration. Tomorrow, we have invited industry taxpayers other than BP to testify. And on Saturday, we are going to be doing statewide public testimony. The first hour will be special interest groups, and the rest of the time will be individual testimony. On Monday morning, we also have time scheduled again at 9:30 a.m., and the committee will have an opportunity to ask the administration and the industry further questions. I also have ELF hearings time scheduled for after Easter break, starting on the 28th, and we'll be following up with a schedule next week after we see how far we get. As you know, the House Resources Committee had 30 hours of hearings on ELF. I don't really know how many hours we're going to end up having, but that's the way we're starting. And Senator Adams, welcome. We're ready for you to begin testimony.
Well, good morning. For the record, my name is Senator Al Adams. I represent District L. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I'm most grateful to this committee on oil and gas for bringing the issue of revising the economic limit factor into open discussions. For too long, the Senate has been silent in an ongoing debate over the merits of revising this part of our oil and gas laws. Hopefully, the testimony that we will hear in the next few days will add to the public's understanding of the economic limit factor and underscore the need for a vote of the full House Senate on this important legislation. Good morning, Mr. President. As a sponsor of Senate Bill number 97, I am often asked why I am in favor of it and why the oil industry, by and large, is so opposed to it. No matter whether you are for or against revising the ELF, the answer to the question is simple. There is big money at stake here, and it is my position that some of the money belongs to the people in our state. Indeed, Madam Chairman, Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk are where the money is. They are two of the most productive and profitable oil fields in the continent. As elected officials, it is our duty to ensure that this enormous public resource returns maximum benefit to its owners, the people of Alaska. That is what taxes are all about, in particular oil and gas taxes. We are obligated to find the financial balance between recouping some of the losses that occurred when resources were removed from the state, yet at the same time not handicap the industry. The tax process needs to be approached with fairness and sensitivity by the government administering it. Because Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk are where the money is, it is the duty of the oil companies to capture as much profit as possible for the owners, the stockholders. The noise surrounding the important issue is nothing more than a head-on collision of these two conflicting duties. Article number 8, section number 2 of the Alaska Constitution says, "The legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and water, for the maximum benefit of its people." This is the duty we are sworn to uphold. And it probably goes without saying that the industry is more than capable of looking out for the interest of its stockholders. I would like to suggest, however, that between public and private interest in North America's largest and most profitable oil field, some common ground can be found in Senate Bill number 97. That particular ground is staked out in my bill. This piece of legislation that you have before you is about fairness. It seeks to close a tax loophole for those it was never intended to benefit. At the same time, it extends benefits to those who need it now but can't qualify. Yes, it's a tax increase for some of those corporations, but for others, it's a tax relief bill. As much, it's both a pro-Alaska bill and a pro-development bill, one designed to capture for Alaska residents and the state treasurer as much revenue as we deserve from our oil on our land, and for the industry to remove barriers for the development of marginal oil fields. That is the intent of my legislation. Certainly, that was the intention of the legislature in 1981 when amendments to Alaska Statute 4355 and other oil and gas tax statutes were adopted. Before getting into the specifics of my bill, I believe it would be helpful to the committee to discuss briefly what I believe the legislature thought it was doing 8 years ago during a rather confusing few days in June. As chairman of House Finance Chairman then, I had a key role in passage of several important bills, including the state budget. In order to balance the budget that year, it was critical that the state address legal challenges raised by the oil industry that placed as much as one-third of Alaska's projected revenues, tax revenues, in jeopardy that year. So in an effort to settle the industry's lawsuit against the state and protect the public's fair share of wealth generated at Prudhoe Bay, amendments to Alaska oil and gas corporate income tax and service tax were passed and signed into law. At the time, the legislature was assured by the former Commissioner of Revenue, Tom Williams, that the proposed law was neutral in terms of generating revenue. That is, whenever money was lost from changes in the corporate income tax would be recovered from changes in the severance tax. In addition, there were indications, if not outright assertions, from industry officials that the adoption of changes would bring an end to the expensive court proceedings that focus on the constitutionality of separate accounting as a means of determining corporate oil and gas income tax payments. As we all know too well, not only was Tom Williams wrong in his predictions of a revenue-neutral bill, but also the legislature was misled into believing the industrious lawsuit would be dropped. It is one of the great ironies of recent Alaska political history that the U.S. Supreme Court evidently upheld the legality of the disputed law, and Alaska lost $1 billion in the process. Many more out-of-court settlements, like that one, and most clients would go looking for a new attorney. Fortunately, the state of Alaska has a little more leverage than the average citizens in tax matter. As Tom Williams reminded the legislature 8 years ago, if his predictions of a revenue-neutral bill were incorrect, the House and Senate could always recover any lost revenue in other ways. Madam Chairman and members of the committee and elected officials, as much as I am tempted, I did not sponsor Senate Bill number 797 out of a desire to seek revenge for the billion-dollar ripoff. Instead, I'm only trying to ensure that Alaskans have as much coming to them as they deserve, and the oil industry no more than it deserves. In the next few days, this committee will undoubtedly hear testimony from the industry warning that if Senate Bill number 97 is enacted, an untold amount of oil will be left in the ground as uneconomical to produce. These warnings should be listened to carefully, because if companies in control of production at Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk wish to do so, for whatever reasons, they are capable of leaving oil in the ground temporarily or forever. At the same time, the state of Alaska has experts who will testify, if allowed to do so, that the modest modifications in my bill should have no appreciable effect on production rates at Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, and in fact, that world oil prices are much more important in determining whether a given barrel of oil is economical to produce. Between these conflicting views, this committee and the entire legislature must choose. But I urge you to recall which of these experts gave assurances to the legislature 8 years ago. If they were wrong then I ask, should we believe in them again? What can we believe in the current ELF debate? If we are to believe the claims made in so many paid advertisements lately, we could believe that the current ELF law is working as it was intended. I believe that that is a lie. That, Madam Chairman, is a lie. Instead, the current ELF law makes only the rich richer. In no way could Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk be considered marginal oil fields right now. In no way does the current ELF law compare with higher oil prices and explaining the apparent resurgence of industry activity in my Senate district. If I believe that the current ELF law was so important to North Slope oil productions, I would not be sponsoring this piece of legislation. Madam Chairman, lately we have seen all the industry's advertisements invoking the words and pictures of past politicians, from Roosevelt to Churchill to Kennedy, as if they were alive and down here lobbying on the ELF issue. I suppose next we'll see the image of Moses climbing down the mountain, carrying the 11th commandment, "Thou shalt not change ELF." But that kind of rewrite of history works both ways, Madam Chairman. I could invoke the words of Teddy Kennedy when he said in 1901, "We demand that big business give people a square deal." And that's what this issue is really about, fairness. Fairness is what Ernest Greene was talking about when he said that the basic issue facing the territory of Alaska 48 years ago was, and I quote from him, "That issue is whether Alaska should be built for Alaskans, or whether it should continue to be governed for and by outside interests, whose sole concern is to take out of Alaska as much as possible, as fast as they can, and leave as little as possible." In Alaska today, we are hearing a different kind of a story through the paid advertisements of the oil and gas industry. In my view, all the hundreds of thousands of dollars being poured into misleading and erroneous advertisements about ELF could have been put to a far better use, finding and producing more oil in my district, or yours, Madam Chairman. The same goes for all the political campaign donations spent by the industry to keep this bill and other bills from passing the legislature. At the same time, and the same goes for the $12 million that the industry removes from Alaska every day instead of reinvesting it. How much did I say? $12 million each day that is removed from this state of Alaska instead of reinvesting in our state. When it comes right down to it, I believe we have to put our instincts on this issue. And before I get to the specifics of this bill, I would ask the committee's indulgence to say a few words about the broader context in which I see the need of a passage of my bill or a bill similar to it. During a recent Senate Majority Caucus, of which you chair, there were discussions of the need to give the Finance Committee all the tools it needs to balance the budget for FY90. Currently, the legislature and the governor are looking at a variety of tax increases and budget cuts to bring our revenue and spending into balance. We may also look into going into our savings account. In considering some of these options for a balanced budget, it is incumbent for us to remember one standard, That one standard is fairness. If we're intended to ask the people of the state of Alaska to pay more in taxes, or to get by with reduced services, or both, then it's only fair that everybody share in that sacrifice. My bill is the only piece of legislation before this body which attempts to ensure that our most profitable corporate citizens help pick up their fair share of the load, while their less fortunate corporate colleagues carry a little less. Madam Chairman and committee members, make no mistake where I stand on the overall problem that we face in the legislative session. I wholeheartedly support responsible reduction in state budget. We cannot afford over the long term the cost of government that we have today. Likewise, we cannot afford our most profitable corporate citizens. We cannot afford to subsidize our most profitable corporate citizens through an unjustified tax break that was intended for others. In the 15 minutes that it had for me to make this presentation, the current ELF law has allowed the producers at Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk to export another $124,500 from the state. By the time this committee completes its 5 days of hearings on Senate Bill number 97, the current ELF law will have sent another $60 million down the pipeline and out of the state. That is wrong. That is wrong. And that is why I have made passage of Senate Bill number 97 and or a similar bill like House Bill number 118 my number one priority for this session. As I said earlier, Madam Chairman, I would not have sponsored this bill if I thought it would hurt my Senate district. I represent a large district in the state of Alaska, an area that includes the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Last year, I was among the legislators who led the fight in supporting the opening a portion of ANWR to oil development, and I still stand today ready and willing to continue that fight here in Juneau or in Washington, D.C. And I personally believe that this bill, Senate Bill number 97, is a step in that direction. For certainly, if oil is found in or near that refuge, then this bill will aid in the development of marginal fields on our land. That is the goal that we as public officials and the industry can agree on. Now, with the permission of the chair, I would like to explain my bill in detail. You have the bill before you, Senate Bill number 97, an act relating to oil and gas properties, production tax, and providing for an effective date. I apologize that not many senators have signed on as co-sponsors for this piece of legislation. Section 1 of this bill would start on page number 1, lines number 9 through 20. This particular section modifies the formula for calculating the economic limit of oil production. It takes into consideration total of field production instead of looking into the per well production, and it repeals the rounding rule. More simply put, it reduces the tax break for Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk and will decrease the tax burden on Endicott, Lisburn, Milne Point, Nyakuk, Point Thompson, and Seal Island. This bill would not change the tax rate for the fields that have an effective severance tax rate of zero under current law. Those fields are Beaver Creek, Granite Point, MacArthur River, Middle Ground Shoals, Swanson River, Trading Bay, and West Sachs. Section number 2, which you'll find on page number 2, lines 21 through 29, page 3, lines 1 through 7, that particular section eliminates the opportunity for a producer to attempt to rebut the presumption that the PEL, which is a monthly production at the economic limit, is 300 barrels per day per well. Section number 3, which you will find on page number 2, line number 8, repeals two sections of the current law relating to PEL rebuttal and hearing provisions, which was eliminated in section number 2. Section number 4, which you will find on page number 2, lines number 9 and 10, this particular section clearly states that the bill applies to oil produced after December 31st, 1988. Madam Chairman, I would like to note for the committee this subject needs to have some debate on this issue. Section number 5 sets out an immediate effective date, and which you will find on page 2, lines number 11. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, House members that have attended, I would like you to thank you for me to present my views on my particular piece of legislation. And I look forward to participating in the continued debate on ELF and trust that the Senate will bring this issue to the floor so that the citizens, our voters of Alaska, can see how their elected representatives stands on this important issue to the state of Alaska, ELF. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and I will be ready for any questions.
Thank you, Senator Adams. I'd like to note the presence of Senator Kelly, also Representatives Boyer and Davidson. Are there any questions for Senator Adams? Senator Halford.
Thank you. Senator Adams, you mentioned the effective date question, but I wonder if you could just amplify. The way the bill is drafted, it would apply to any oil produced after December 31st, 1988, as I understand it. What are the differences in the ranges in there?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Senator, one of the things that I would like the committee to look at is the effective date, because there the House has been very carefully to look at House Bill number 118 and the constitutionality of retroactive effective dates. I personally believe that by looking at the lawsuits that has been handed down, that we can basically go further than the one that has been stated in here on the December effective date. I would basically ask this committee to go back to June 20th, 1987. So that we can recover more than $400 million, which is rightfully belongs to the state treasurer and the people in the state of Alaska. I also note that under federal law, that under due process, proper notice have to be given. Madam Chairperson, proper notice has been given by the passage and the changes made in the tax structure in June of 1981. Proper notification has been given by the introduction, a session of GO on House Bill number 164. Proper notice have been given to the industry. The industry have been given proper notice to the people in the state of Alaska by its paid advertisements since 1985 or earlier. So proper notice, and I believe that we should be looking basically at the effective date for June 20th, and that's why I said earlier, instead of December of 1988.
Other questions for Senator Adams?
Madam Chairman, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Senator Frank, you're welcome to join us at the table if you'd like. Next we have Mr. George Nelson, President of BP Exploration, Inc.
Mr. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of our committee. My name, for the record, is George N. Nelson, and I am president of BP Exploration Alaska, Inc. On my right, and I will address a little bit more about Mr. Williams, but Tom Williams is a member of our tax department within BP Exploration Alaska, Inc. Thank you again, Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for allowing me and Mr. Williams to be here today and to testify on a very important matter, as
Senator Adams has previously testified to that's before this body. In 1986, you knew us as Sohio Alaska Petroleum Company. In 1987 and 88, you knew us as Standard Alaska Production Company. And now, in 1989, we are the same company with a new name. And I hope that this will be the last time that we have a name change, as I'm sure you will agree. This is not what we think is name change stability. With me today is Tom Williams. Most of you already know him. I consider Tom to be the most knowledgeable person in the state on the subject of elk. He fathered it, and I think we're still looking for the mother, but when he was the director of the Petroleum Revenue Department for the state of Alaska. You may be wondering why I'm here testifying when he knows more about the history and the formula. It's because this bill is about producing oil, and that's been my job for over 30 years. I started in the oil business in Venezuela in 1955. Back then, Venezuela was viewed a lot like Saudi Arabia is today. Its reserves seemed unlimited. But then something happened in 1957. The government increased taxes on the oil business retroactively to the tune of $380 million. And there has not been one single major oil field discovery since then in Venezuela. I, like most others, moved on shortly after Venezuela's tax policy changed. I went to Libya, where I stayed from 1967 to 1975. Libya also has a high tax, high government control approach to the production of their natural resources. As a result, Libya's production also has not met its potential either. Since 1985, I've worked on the Prudhoe Bay and North Slope oil fields. Our company has a 50% interest in Prudhoe Bay, a 37% interest in Kuparik, and a 56% interest in Endicott, and a 20% interest in Lisbon. I mention all this background because I think we can learn from the past, but we can't live in the past. And it appears to me, after looking over the testimony in the House version of the most recent ELF bill, that there's a dangerous emphasis and a tendency to look at the past with no look to the future. Tom can answer your questions about what happened with ELF between 1977 and 1981, and further details if required, but I want to talk about the future. How important are giant oil fields like Prudhoe Bay, and how much tax and royalty should they pay? Without Prudhoe, there would have been no $10 billion investment in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. There would be no Kuparik. There would be no Endicott. There would be no Lisbon. Without a large commercial field in Anwar, there will be no pipeline from Anwar to Taps. Without the potential for a large commercial find in Anwar, there would be no incentive to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to explore that. Over the next decade, the vast majority of the new oil reserves on the North Slope should come from Prudhoe Bay and Kuparik. But it'll only happen if there's a commercial incentive to fully develop these two giant fields. I think Senate Bill 97 would accomplish exactly the opposite. We would pay a lower tax rate on Prudhoe production of 1.4 million barrels a day than we do on 1.5 million barrels a day. This bill is written to reward less production from large and small fields alike. The message does not encourage investment of money to boost recovery. Lower production will be rewarded with lower taxes. Is that really what was intended? I don't think so. Prudhoe and Kuparik have been characterized as extremely profitable oil fields that can and should pay as much tax now as they did when prices were twice what they are now. During the first half of the 80s, they were highly profitable, and Alaska shared fully and fairly in that profit. In the seven-year period between 1980 and 1986, the state collected nearly $25 billion in taxes and royalties. That's more than $7,000 per resident per year. Put another way, an Alaskan family of four had some $200,000 in taxes and royalties paid on their behalf by the oil industry during this period. The heyday is over, and I, for one, don't think the state or the industry will see times like those again, at least not in this century. Since 1986, our North Slope operations have been far less profitable. I use 1986 as a measuring point because that is when the price of oil changed, as you know, from December of 1985 at about some $25 to $28 a barrel, and things from there went downhill. And so this is why the period 86, 87, and 88. Since 1986, as I said, our North Slope operations have been far less profitable. Based on our own experience, the oil industry's return on North Slope investment between 1986 and 1988, and that's for the three-year period in full, average 10% a year. Compare that to the Alaska Permanent Fund, which is pursuing a conservative investment policy of avoiding risks, and very much rightfully so, has generated a 12% average annual return over the same three-year period. During this three-year period, we have reported some $540 million a year in after-tax profits from North Slope production. During the same period, we paid the state of Alaska and its municipalities some $750 million a year in taxes and royalties on North Slope production. During this same period, we reinvested 80% of our production profits in North Slope exploration and development, an average of more than $430 million a year. When the state's oil and gas tax legislation was last overhauled in 1981, there was a consensus between the legislative leadership and the administration that the state's fair share of the oil production profits should never fall below 30%. This corresponded roughly with a third for the state, a third for the industry, and a third for the federal government. According to the studies by the Alaska Department of Revenue, the state's share was always more than 30% between 1981 and June of 1987. We know, and administration statements confirm, that the state's share is still above 30%. Based on the state's current official price forecast of $7.36 wellhead value for fiscal year 89, the state is receiving almost half, 49% of the wellhead value of the oil after lifting costs and depreciation are taken out. The industry share is roughly a third, 34%. Even using the administration's numbers, which are based on a value at Valdez and include pipeline tariffs, the state's share is still 36%. Plenty of things besides oil prices have a significant impact on the profitability of Prudhoe and Kuparuk. Two of the most important are costs and the level of production. Prudhoe has been producing oil for nearly 12 years now, and Kuparuk's been producing for more than seven. As you know, the North Slope has one of the harshest climates in the world. Because maintenance costs were higher than anticipated, our expenses surpassed our budget by $40 million last year alone. Now that our Prudhoe Bay facilities are operating at capacity, we can no longer make up for production lost due to maintenance, weather conditions, or complications with tanker shipments. That means we're spreading higher costs over fewer barrels. Unfortunately for all of us, costs will continue to rise and production will continue to decline. Excuse me. So what exactly does this have to do with ELF? ELF takes into account the fact that oil production doesn't become marginal overnight. It's a gradual process, and that's how the ELF responds. Prudhoe Bay currently pays about a 12% production tax. That's a very high rate, far higher than the 4.9% rate in Texas and 7.1% in Oklahoma, but it's 3% lower than it was. Prudhoe Bay was subject to the 10-year rounding rule until June of 1987. ELF links the payment of taxes to the ability to pay them, and that's a good tax policy. The ELF also contains an incentive to drill new wells and to maximize recovery from existing ones. This incentive will play a key role in slowing the decline in production at Prudhoe Bay and Kupari. It's also creating private sector jobs for Alaskans and millions of dollars in revenues for Alaskan contractors. Consider, for example, our Hurl State development, a small, marginal development within, I repeat, a small, marginal development within the huge Prudhoe Bay field. Hurl State represents an investment of some $80 million, and it will boost recovery at Prudhoe Bay by some 37 million barrels of oil. That's 37 million barrels of oil more for the state to tax and collect royalties. And also the tax on ad valorem property tax. Just as important, it means jobs for Alaskans. In all, Pearl State will create some 300 construction jobs over a two-year period. And we have already demonstrated our commitment to use Alaskan contractors to perform the work. We recently awarded some $12 million of these contracts to Alaskan firms to perform a portion of this work on Hurl State, to union and non-union firms in Anchorage and Fairbanks. And there's more work to be done, drilling, installation, and other projects. We have also recently awarded a $5 million contract to Doyon Drilling, a Native Corporation joint venture to design, build, and operate a workover rig at Prudhoe Bay. Workover rigs are used to perform remedial work on older wells to increase recovery. Native firms play an important role in our development activities and in our day-to-day operations, from catering to drilling, from materials handling to maintenance. Senate Bill 97 would discourage projects like Pearl State and workovers. It encourages us not to drill. It encourages us also not to maximize production. Under certain circumstances, and again I say under certain circumstances, adding production for new wells would increase taxes on all other production. Again, I do not believe that that was your intention. In the House, a lot of the debate is centered on what the bill would do for small, marginal fields. Smaller North Slope fields should not be ignored. But there's no reason incentives for small fields have to be linked to major tax increases on large fields. Our experience with Nyakot and Endicott, two fields that would qualify as small and marginal under the terms of Senate Bill 97, has been that permitting can be a much bigger hurdle to develop. And I can't overemphasize the fact that the current ELF provides adequate relief from the high nominal rate for small fields like Milne Point. Because of the current ELF, Milne Point paid no production tax for several months prior to shutdown, 6.5 months to be exact. No production tax. I can't think of a bigger production tax incentive than paying no taxes at all. What Milne Point did continue to pay, which was a problem, as everyone here knows, was an effective royalty in excess of 18%. Senate Bill 97 does not provide royalty relief. The changes proposed in the ELF are not really designed to encourage development and production in small fields, or at least in our opinion, they're intended to raise revenues to support state government spending. Why does state government spending require so much support in Alaska? For one thing, the number of state employees is growing by 1,312 between November of 1987 and November of 1988, according to the administration's own numbers, and the state budget continues to grow. Changing the ELF will harm the industry, and it will also harm the state. It could force the industry to defer expenditures and investments. It would also send a clear message to all potential private investors that this state is determined to tax at any rate necessary to maintain a spending rate at 4.5 times the national per capita average. We at BP are currently planning to spend between $2 and $2.5 billion on North Slope development over the next 5 years. This 5-year spending plan is expected to add 750 million barrels of reserves for BP alone to produce, which means gross 1.5 billion barrels of oil, and twice that much, as I said, for the state to tax and collect royalty on. This committee, I'm sure, understands that most of our projects at this point in time are close to the margin already. Cost increases could force us to forego some of them, such as Hurl State. Changing the ELF will also reinforce the industry's fears that every time the state of Alaska has a budget problem, we are going to have the bill sent to us. $30 oil is a thing of the past. It ended years ago. It's 1989 now, and we've got lower prices and higher costs. Soon, we'll have less production as well. And as you know, soon is now. We do have less production. But we've also got something else, a broader and stronger support industry, as our current mini-module fabrication and pipe insulation contract work in Fairbanks attest to. There are many factors influencing our decisions on whether to go forward with development projects. We cannot control the price of oil. We cannot control inflation. We can't stop facilities from aging, and we cannot stop reservoirs from declining. But we can try to convince you not to increase our cost by imposing a new tax burden by changing the ELF formula, and that's why we're here today. The ELF encourages development, we think, the kind that helps Alaska build a strong private sector to fuel its future. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Questions for Mr. Nelson, Mr. Adams?
Mr. Nelson, in your opening remarks, that you made a remark that the ELF legislation, 71 and also 81, the father was Tom Williams. 81, if I can help you out and remind you, the mother then was Ed Dankworth, through amendment number 3. You know what happens when a mother and father get behind closed doors? But except in this particular case, the people of Alaska was on the end of that relationship, that they lost $1 billion. I have a series of questions I'd like to ask you. At a wellhead price of $10, what would be your per barrel cost if we amended the ELF at this particular time?
I don't know. I mean, we didn't come. We can figure it out, I suppose, for you. And I would say this. There may be many questions, with all due respect, Madam Chairman and Senator Adams, that we may not be able to answer to precisely at this point in time. We would be most happy for you to submit those questions to us or give them to us, and we will return them to you in writing so that you have them for the record and for further use.
Okay, then I'll change maybe going to some general questions then. Regarding your Alaska operations, no matter what name you're going under today, what percentage of people that's employed by your company are Alaska residents? Do you have a figure yet?
Oh, yeah, I can tell you that. Because, as you well know, Senator, I served on the local hire committee several times under the previous administration, and so local hire has been a point of interest for quite some time. We currently have 1,316 permanent employees at BP Alaska, of which 96% of our Alaskan residents. We have, and I'll go one step further to say, project, the goal that is set forth on Alaska residents, Alaska Native residents, and Alaska North Slope Native residents. The overall contractor numbers that we have, and from our monthly report dated through January the 31st anyway, was that the overall number was something on the order of 82% for overall. It was something on the order of 10%, as I remember, for the Alaska Natives, and something on the order of about 2% for the North Slope Native, North Slope rural population. Now, these are contractors that work in our direct responsibility. Of other contractors that work for us that have higher numbers, of course, that do construction work, we do require the same type of thing in their contracts when they bid those. They do have goals that they've also set. They are also included in that same category.
I'd like, if I can, get a list of that percentage from your operations.
Sure.
I appreciate it. And I know that today that you're here trying to also protect your shareholders. And basically, I, as a legislator, is trying to also do the same thing, protect our shareholders, the Alaska residents. A reason, but I'm trying to help the Alaska residents, and don't you think, though, a reasonable deal on a depletion of our natural resources, is that what you should be working on as elected officials?
Well, I think that most assuredly, as you stated in your testimony, and you're now saying that that is your job, that is a correct statement, and I could agree with that, just as you said that it is my position and job to protect the company and the shareholders. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Adams. Senator Halford.
Thank you. And just trying to figure it out, and I also have a hard time chasing names, but who owns Sohio? I mean, what really is the corporate makeup of Sohio? Mm-hmm. I know that we're dealing with the Sohio Alaska Corporation, but where essentially are the stockholders?
Well, number one, whatever our name is, in any of the days or years that we've done with, we are a subsidiary, and we're a subsidiary of the Standard Oil Company Incorporated in New Jersey, which was then in 1978, by the effect of what they did with the merger with British Petroleum, which acquired 54% at that point in time, owned a percentage of the preferred stock at that point in time. And later on, as you well know, in fact, last year, they purchased for about $7.5 billion the remaining 46% of the corporation. So the corporation, of the old Standard Oil Corporation, is now owned by British Petroleum, which is their corporate headquarters are located in London in the United Kingdom.
Just a follow-up, and who owns British Petroleum? British Petroleum owns all of?
Yes, and British Petroleum now is owned principally by private shareholders in the UK, as well as the people that when they sold their stock in the merger, and when that came about, were offered an opportunity also to participate as shareholders within BP. Now, the main shareholders are in London, and are BP shareholders.
So the British government doesn't own any more?
No, the British government, as you well know, sold, or I think you do anyway, that had the sale of their 30-some percent ownership, and that was purchased either by private outside people, and as you well know, I'm sure the Kuwait Investment Corporation, which is the government of Kuwait, at some point in time when that was happening, because of the depressed prices, achieved a 22% ownership. That, as you may be aware of, when we just recently sold Kennecott and all of our minerals worldwide, not only in the United States but worldwide, we acquired a $4.3 billion cash sale, of which we went and repurchased all but 9% of the remaining stock from the Kuwait Investment Corporation. We have, and they have, another 3 years over which to divest themselves, and we to repurchase the remaining 9%.
So essentially Kuwait owns 9% now. Is that the...
That's right.
And there's a repurchase agreement?
Oh, yes.
Between the two.
In there so that they will no longer own that within a three-year period.
Maybe Tom can... I mean, somebody has to have done some kind of numbers on an impact per barrel of this legislation or of the House-proposed legislation. I'm not sure exactly what the differences are. But, Tom, have you got any analysis of the per-barrel impact of this legislation at any given point? And I realize it will change according to the market price of oil. But what are we talking about per barrel?
At the price levels that we're looking at, you know, it's on the order of something less than 30 cents. It could, depending on exactly what price you want to plug into the formula. If you plug in $7.36, I think you come out with a lower number. If you plug in a price that's based on the current spot market today on the Gulf Coast or something like that, and then that back, that would be higher. You'd have a higher cost.
So somewhere between 15 and 30 cents a barrel?
I would think it's more like somewhere between 25 cents and 30 cents, but again, it depends on...
That's an optimistic view of oil price.
Well, maybe $7.36 is a little conservative.
Pessimistic, yeah. I agree. Can I continue?
Sure.
I got one other question. It seems that the basic premise upon which the comparison of the formula was started in 78 was that the number of wells drilled was of benefit to the state. And I think Tom is probably the one. Should I go ahead and address this to Tom? Because I mean, historically, there's I think three or four of us in the room that were involved then. But what I'm curious about is that we made a determination that it was in the state's interest to essentially have more wells. We made that determination, I assume, because of the effect on production and possibly some consideration for the effect on jobs. And what I'm curious about is what has happened to the cost per well for drilling in real dollars over the period from the initial institution of the formula in 1978 to now.
Well, there are several things to what you're asking about. The cost of drilling the well is one thing, but the amount of reserves that you recover, we run the economics just like we do on a full project on each and every well. And we plan to do our 5-year plan, and then from that to the 1-year operating plan for the preceding, the succeeding year. Every well in there has the economics run on it on the amount of reserves that you recover. Now, so in terms of the numbers on that, wells used to take us 36 days and cost about $3.5 million in 1975, 6, 7, and 8. They currently, our average drilling days are about 19 in Prudhoe Bay. And I'll qualify that by saying that they're $2.4 million. That's tangible and intangible. And that's also for an average measured depth of 11,000 feet. But
so,
it still makes a difference. For instance, right now when we started out with 160-acre well spacing with a decided amount of our reserves that we thought we could recover. Of the $22 billion in place, by the way the whole field was laid out by three different companies with three different answers, but approximately together, we decided how much and how many wells were going to be required at that point in time. As you go along and you produce the field and you obtain production history, those things will change from time to time. That well, and everybody when they looked at that and we said drill additional wells, you knew in a field this size you were going to go down to 80 acre spacing, which we are right now, and you could conceivably go down to 40 acre spacing, which we have not done. that is in our five-year plan, and those numbers that I just quoted, $2 to $2.5 billion in the next 5 years. However, not all companies agree with this at this point in time, because one of the major owners has great reservations that the wells will be economical on 40-acre spacing, meaning that the cost to drill and over the period of time of the amount of recovery from that individual well may not be there.
But if I can, the cost in 1975-76 was $3.5 million.
In 1975, 6, and 7, 7, and $77.
Okay. Was so $3.5 million of those dollars, and today it's $2.4 million of these dollars?
That's right.
So if inflation were taken into there, the cost per well might be a quarter of what it was then.
That's right, because as you can see, I said it took 36 days, and we've almost halved it. We're down to 19 days. And these are the things that we have learned by being there over the years, which is incumbent upon us to do.
Is part of that directional drilling?
No, the directional drilling wells, the thing about the horizontal wells more than anything, all those are directionally drilled. They're, what we call a directionally drilled well is up to about 40 degree deviation, maybe 50 degrees. And anything you go from 50 up is what we classify as a high angle or a horizontal well. High angle and horizontal wells go all the way up to 86 degrees, and they, in fact, we do have some that we even are around on a 90 degree after a long deviation. But anyhow, those wells are averaging about $4 million today, and $1987, I should say. We haven't drilled a horizontal well this year. In $1988, and those wells take us approximately 32 days at this point in time to drill. There's a lot more finesse and sophistication to drilling horizontal wells on a high angle deviation than the normal, what we call normal wells.
How many wells, when you say 160-acre spacing or a given spacing, that doesn't necessarily mean a grid that's got wells 160 acres at each intersection? Because apparently, I mean, you have a pad that essentially has a number of wells drilled from a single setup and a single pad.
That's right. And on that single pad, it most certainly does mean a grid at 160-acre spacing, because we're talking about bottom hole location. Surface center lines on wells initially in Poodle Bay were 110 feet. Center lines on Poodle Bay wells now are 35 feet. But it's all in the, and some of those wells are high angle wells, above 50 degrees, but that's right. Pad sets up here, they're all in line up here, but the bottom hole targets were initially on 160-acre spacing. We can go back in, as you can see, we were 110, we're going back in on some of those pads and getting between those 110s on the 50-foot spacing and drilling back in between them. Now we're taking that bottom hole target, placing it with another, and we're back on 80-acre spacing.
So that's probably part of the cost savings per well, because you can drill a lot more from a single pad.
Right, and just to demonstrate that even further, which shows that our footprint now, and a lot of people worry about that, how much ground we cover with facilities and pads. At Endicott, we have, that's on two islands, 56 acres of gravel, and we're drilling on 10-foot centers. So again, we've advanced the technology enough, and I don't mean just we BP, we industry working on the North Slope have been able to do that, and that's enabled us to reduce costs. That's correct.
Thank you. That's all I got.
May I have a follow-up question to that?
Yes, and then I have some questions.
The statements about changing the well spacing or reducing the number of space between parallel and vertical wells. Is this a way to take advantage of the current elf production and rate right now?
No. No, in fact, no, it is not. No, it has nothing to do with elf.
I would hold that question for later, because to look at that very closely.
Actually, I'd like to follow up, I believe, probably on Senator Adams's question. Mr. Nelson, one of the things that I've heard the governor say twice now publicly is that the industry has been drilling wells purposely to take advantage of the elf and then only operating or producing the wells for an hour a day. Can you give us an idea, please, of what you go through in order to get the state's permission to actually drill a well, and what sort of production you have and What wells have you drilled that you're only producing 1 hour a day?
Well, the permitting process, first, before that takes place, Madam Chairman, we have to have agreement now, and that makes the bottom hole locations on wells in Prudhoe Bay that much more difficult because we have over 700 wells at this point in time, and I mean agreement between the three major owners. As I said before, on 40-acre spacing right now, we have one major owner that has great reservations about that, and so there are no approvals for that. But first, we have to get unit approval amongst all the three companies on a technical basis as to where the bottom hole targets are. We then have to prepare all the paperwork that's necessary to go through with that and apply at the Oil and Gas Commission and review it on a well-by-well and permit-by-permit basis. That permitting process has worked reasonably until just recently, and then we've run into the problem not with the wells, but from the standpoint of the reserve pits, and that is a matter with the Department of Environmental Conservation. We have changed our way of doing business on reserve pits on and within Prudhoe Bay, and then into Kaparik, and then into Endicott. So hopefully we'll be able in the future to do and to satisfy the requirements there. But it takes us an average of only about, from the time we submit the permit to the Oil and Gas Commission, it takes maybe 30 days at most. We spend more time on the preparation internally with the documents and obtaining our own internal approvals internal to the working interest owners than we do anything else. Now, to answer the question about producing oil from a well for only 1 hour to receive credit for something that with the elk, that I can assure you is not the case whatsoever. As we said, Prudhoe Bay, and you've read recently that we are at that point in time right now where we can't make rate. Last year, for the first time, Prudhoe Bay did not produce 1.5 million average for the year. We produced only 1,450,000. That was not done for anything on purpose to give us some type of a tax advantage. We try to produce every barrel that we can from that standpoint. There is absolutely no reason for us to operationally produce anything less than what we can produce from those wells.
Madam Chairman, also an additional thought, and that is that even if there were something, you know, that people would try to do that, there's a regulation now that the Department of Revenue has adopted that says you look at the hours in a month that a well is operated and divide it by 24, and that gives you the number of days that counts. So even if people were going to play that sort of game, which they weren't doing deliberately, you know, it can't be played with any success. 24-hour day for every well.
When was that regulation adopted?
Last year, I think.
So, Mr. Nelson, as I understand you, the Prudhoe Bay producers have to have permission from the State of Alaska's Oil and Gas Conservation Commission in order to drill a specific well.
Absolutely.
Before you can drill it.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. My next question, the Professor Deacon's report that was presented yesterday afternoon, although you weren't in the audience, I suspect you have seen it. And the number of total North Slope invest, or the dollar figure for total North Slope investments that this report purports to be accurate is $25 billion, and the Prudhoe Bay figure is $8.5 billion. That is a figure very different from the number that both the state and certainly the producing companies and certainly other people that I'm familiar with have been using in Congress in the Anwar debate. Can you speak to that? Have you spent more or less than, by the way, the number that we've been using back in D.C. is higher. The states testified that it's higher. The industries testified that it's higher. Why did Mr. Deacon come up with a different number than what we've been using?
Madam Chairman, I don't know. We received the report yesterday afternoon at 2 o'clock in our office. I saw it at about 5 o'clock. And we picked up, as you well might imagine, as you have and others, that there is a difference there. our numbers show, and we have brochures as well as our annual reports, as well as the other major owners within Prudhoe Bay, showing that our total investment there is more like something on the order of $12.5 billion, and I don't know what the difference is. We have people that are working on that right now to try to reconcile where the differences are, and I might add there are several other numbers in the report that we're not familiar with, and we're trying to reconcile those as well, but we just haven't had time to do that, but we're in the process of doing that.
Thank you, and I just have one more question, then we have Senator Kelly and Senator Halford. Mr. Nelson, how many dollars a year, or let's say how many dollars last year did BP exploration put into communities throughout Alaska in what I would call either gifts to the arts, just community, gifts to the communities or working with the communities?
Our corporate contributions last year in Alaska, including United Way, was approximately $1.1 million.
Thank you. Senator Kelly.
George, most of the oil companies in Alaska are opposing a change in the ELF factor. Conoco is supporting it. Why?
Well, for their own corporate reasons, one of the things that that happened to Conoco is that they're at a disadvantage, as I said in my testimony, with respect to the royalty payment, which they started out the same as others at about the normal 1/8, and in an agreement with the state, in order to extend the leases so that they could go ahead and start production because they hadn't got to that point, there was an agreement made, and they came back and requested and agreed to a higher royalty rate. That has cost them. Also, since they are not owners and a common carrier downstream, they don't. That costs them a little bit more. And in the beginning, they produced for 14 months, if my memory serves me correctly. And when the price of oil was high enough, the severance tax did not affect them that much. But they have to get over about $20 to $22 a barrel just to break even with all the factors considered. So right now, with the way the bill is structured, they believe and perceive that it will be advantageous to them. And therefore, if that's the case, as Senator Adams said previously, they're looking after their company profits and their shareholders.
So it's in Conoco's self-interest.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about that.
Senator Halford.
I don't have any questions right now.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Davidson. Tried to call you Senator.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Mr. Nelson, aside from a decade-plus tax policy debate on... Thank you. Mr. Nelson, aside from a decade-plus tax policy debate on state-owned oil produced on state-owned property, do you consider Alaska a stable political environment?
That's kind of a loaded question. In general, I would say yes, that Alaska has been stable politically. In general, yes.
In your opening remarks, you made reference to Libya and Venezuela, and certainly it sounds as though you've had a very interesting life with the industry and have been in many interesting places. So I'm assuming then that company investments in these various areas of the world that have oil, whether it's state-owned or publicly owned or privately owned, commercial considerations or commercial incentives, as you speak about, including profit projections, also consider political restraints. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So if you do not have the political restraint consideration in Alaska, just what specific commercial incentives do you rely on to encourage or to make the decision as to whether or not you invest in some place like Alaska?
Well, maybe I'm missing what you're saying. You mean in Alaska relative to someplace else or someplace else relative to Alaska? Is that?
No, I guess I'm asking in Alaska relative to Alaska. Are there specific disincentives, commercial disincentives, for you to invest in Alaska? Is it just the tax policy, or are there other considerations as well?
Well, no. There are considerations as to the way we do our business from the standpoint of something that's been mentioned many times before, and that's the way that we have built, fabricated, transported from the lower 48 and installed on the North Slope large facilities. that has affected us in the past because it is impossible at this point in time to build 1,500 ton to 5,000 ton modules within the state of Alaska. So that high prices, I guess, is what that would say, the high cost of construction relative to other places. But, and also, in all honesty to your question, from the standpoint of the overall part of things, with being able to do part of our construction and fabrication here and part of it elsewhere, with tax policy, be it ELF, be it ad valorem, be it corporate or anything else, all things being equal, and that we have been able to depend on, all projects are planned, as you well know. It's sure the state does the same thing, and it's not just a payback in 1 year or 2 years. You're looking at being able to pay these projects back over a 15 to 20 year period. So the guessing game starts with everybody on the forecasting the price of oil, and your forecast, I guarantee you, would be just as good as mine personally or our company's, because no one has ever been right. But, and as I said, my testimony, we can't control inflation, we can't control the price of oil, but the things that we can depend on and stay fairly constant are the things that we rely on when we say, okay, this project will give us this kind of a return, and then we look at this same type of a project or another one in some other area other than Alaska and say it'll give that return, and, you know, based on that is how the decisions are made. When we go to the, as all corporations do, and all of the oil corporations' corporate offices and boards are located outside the state of Alaska, no one that I know of in the state of Alaska has the authority on their own, myself included, to make the decisions on these large projects. That has to go to the central part of the corporation, and they not only look at what we're asking for, they look at what other parts of the company is asking for. So in the past, as you said, the political climate within the state of Alaska, and then the relating that to the tax climate, which is something that we have to build into our economics, has been stable. And so therefore, as you know, we have invested one of the figures that they had in the report that the Madam Chairman referred to, we say it's been over $30 billion rather than what they show. But anyway, we naturally wouldn't invest that kind of money had we not thought at that time when we ran the economics out on everything and looked at it that it was not going to be a good environment to invest in.
Madam Chairman, if I may follow up here.
Representative Davidson, you really do need to cut off now so that the Department of Revenue has an opportunity to make their full presentation today. If you could hold your question, I would very much appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We will have an opportunity after the hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members.
Next, we have the administration, and I believe Department of Revenue. I don't know. Commissioner Malone? It is my intent for you to go ahead with your presentation until 10 minutes until 11 when we will adjourn to go to the floor. Then we will start tomorrow morning with questions to the administration by the committee. Mr. Commissioner, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Hugh Malone, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Madam Chairman, today I'd like to make a presentation in two parts. I would like to make some opening remarks about the legislation and have Mr. Erickson continue the presentation, if that's agreeable with the committee. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the administration supports Senate Bill 97. Like a similar bill we support in the House, Senator Adams' bill will correct what we regard as an historic defect in our oil tax laws, improve incentives for development of marginal oil fields, and I should think facilitate agreement on the fiscal year 90 budget legislation. Madam Chairman, what I would like to do is to go kind of briefly over at least where, how I think we got to where we are today and what we need to do about it. There's been a considerable amount of talk about tax stability or the lack thereof, and in a, from a synopsis presentation, I think that at the beginning of the Prudhoe Bay development, the state had a fairly well-balanced tax policy. We had an income tax that was sensitive to income. We had a severance tax that was adjusted by the ELF, but at a substantially lower rate than today's severance tax. And we had the royalty, which was in place prior to the tax law changes in 77 and 78. In 1981, when substantial changes were made in the state tax law, particularly the repeal of the separate accounting income tax and an attempted substitution of the increase in the severance tax to generate the revenue, a couple things happened. Number one is the sort of three legs that gave the stability to the state's tax policy. One of them, at least, was cut off at the knee. And secondly, we built into our tax law, our severance tax law, what I sometimes refer to as a time bomb. In 1981, as you know, the legislature suspended through various operations of the law. They suspended the effect of the economic limit factor on the large reservoir at Prudhoe Bay. And they put in a time limit on that suspension, which ran out in June 1987, 10 years after deduction began. Madam Chairman, this graph that has been put up there kind of shows the effects of that up until the tax law changes in 1981, up until June of 1987. The effective severance tax rate of Prudhoe Bay was the same as the nominal rate. It was at 15% due to the suspension. In June of 1987, the effective severance tax rate dropped to approximately 12%. It dropped all at once. And as you can see from the red line on this chart, at least under the current projections for the development of that field, it will continue to decline at a relatively steady rate of about 0.4% per year into the foreseeable future due to the effects of the ELF. At the time the state's tax policy was originally devised, this sort of thing was anticipated, but the elements of the tax policy that made something like this perhaps an acceptable part of a tax regime are no longer there. Specifically, an effective income tax on the income from oil production in Alaska. Since we are relying, and since it is state policy to rely on this tax, I submit that this sudden discontinuity in our income stream, which in that year, fiscal 88, cost the state $135 million, does not represent any sort of stability. It does not represent a coherent tax policy. And so that's why this administration, the governor, myself, other people that work for the governor, believe that changes need to be made to the law. Since that suspension ran out and since there have been no other changes to the severance tax structure, the total losses there compared with just leaving the suspension in place, the present time exceed $200 million. Due to that quirk or time bomb that was built into the law in 81. Now, it's been mentioned that it's not necessarily a good idea to make a change today because of something that happened in the past. And a particular change may not be indicated. And I guess I agree with that. I agree with that philosophy. But I think that the doesn't hold a whole lot of water when we look at the proposal that's before the committee, Senate Bill 97. Senate Bill 97 makes what I would say a progressive change in the tax law. The actual impact of it, I think, is described by Mr. Williams earlier accurately. Relatively small amount of money, looking at the total take that's coming out, puts us back roughly where we used to be, and does it in a way that we believe will encourage development. Madam Chairman, I think that probably the best use of the committee's time might be to let Mr. Erickson make his presentation. I would say that a lot of times we hear the argument that, well, there are specific projects in various fields that if we change the economic limit factor formula, that those projects might be brought into doubt, or they might not take place, and therefore oil be left in the ground. I think there's a couple considerations there. The first consideration is that, as far as I can tell, looking at the analyses that have been done, that even if oil were left in the ground, the income to the state would be higher with these tax law changes. But secondly, that probably the oil won't be left there. We're not proposing to repeal ELF, we're proposing to modify it. Finally, if that is a major consideration for the committee, of course, there's a relatively simple way of dealing with that, and is to provide some special treatment for those kinds of infield projects. Our analysis shows that would cost the state something off the projected income stream from this legislation on the scale of $5 to $10 million a year out of $150 to $200 million. So those sorts of things would be accommodated if they ultimately become are shown to be necessary, and I would say that this change in law is something that is overdue. Since we began discussion of it, I think in the legislative session in 1986, something on the order of 2 billion barrels of oil has been produced, and every day another 2 million barrels is going out. With that, Madam Chairman, I would like to introduce Mr. Greg Erickson.
Why did we change the tax law in 1981?
Madam Chairman, as nearly as I recall, the legislature was worried about the liability that was accruing to the state due to litigation lodged against the separate accounting income tax law, and so they decided to repeal that law. Substitute for it something that they didn't believe would result in major litigation, and I think that was a reason.
That's the way I was here, and that's the way I remember it. We had a severance tax litigation going on. There had been a couple of rulings in other states that made our case look particularly vulnerable. We had $1 billion liability at the time, with a potential of having a $6 billion liability if it went forward and we lost a case. So what we did, in fact, was cut our losses and go to a different system.
Senator Howard, do you have a question?
Well, I'll save my statement. It's not exactly the total liability.
Okay. Commissioner, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The parting shot at Senator Kelly, of course, the state did prevail in that litigation.
sometimes you luck out.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Greg Erickson. I'm an economist in the governor's office. I've been working on this issue of the ELF for a long time. And it's taken a long time to get this issue before the Senate. Madam Chairman, I want to thank you for your role in bringing it here so that we can present our side of the case, our evidence. I'd like to take the brief time remaining to me to summarize the evidence as I see it. I was particularly interested to hear Mr. Nelson's presentation this morning because I think it typifies the evidence that's been presented by the other side. Frankly, while I have a great deal of respect for Mr. Nelson personally and for all the individuals in the oil industry who presented evidence, I think the industry has a credibility problem on this issue. Mr. Nelson said that he likes the ELF now. And in fact, he said that, I can't overemphasize the fact that the current ELF provides adequate relief from the high normal rate for small fields like Milne Point. Madam Chairman, I have a handout here that, with your permission, I'd like to provide to the committee. In it, ten years ago, that's not the tune that Mr. Nelson's company, which was then known as Standard Oil Company of Ohio, was singing. Mr. Richard Donaldson, who was the representative of Standard Oil Company of Ohio in Juneau in March of 1977, said that the proposed ELF legislation would, quote, wipe out any remaining incentives for future development in Alaska. That's exactly the legislation that Mr. Nelson is now saying he likes. Ken Showalter of Standard Oil Company of Ohio said the ELF would increase state oil and severance. Richard Donaldson again said that the tax bills could make subsidiary fields at Prudhoe Bay impossible to produce. These are the same fields that Mr. Nelson is today saying are adequately treated by the ELF. Mr. Nelson also mentioned the fair share, which is an issue we haven't heard for quite some time. The industry raised the issue quite some time ago, but it sort of let it lie for a while. And he said that the state had in 1981 agreed with the oil industry that 30% would be a fair share. Well, I'd like to read you what the oil industry did agree to in 1981. In hearings before the Joint Gas Pipeline Committee on May 21, 1981, Mr. Monty Taylor of Exxon USA responded to the following legislative question. What percent do you think the state should collect? Mr. Taylor's response was, quote, something a little lower than it is now, about half the income tax, for instance. I think it would be much more fair for the industry and the state to get about the same share out of Prudhoe Bay, even though we are paying the expenses and we made the investment. The legislator followed up on that and asked, so you think it should be brought down to the point where the state and industry get roughly equal shares in this? You like that better? Mr. Taylor, yes, sir. And following up that line of questioning with Mr. Richard Donaldson, the representative of Mr. Nelson's company at that time, the legislator asked, did I hear you say you would concur on that, referring to Mr. Taylor's statement? Mr. Donaldson replied, quote, I think that if you get rough parity with the state, we would have to think a long time as an industry, as a company, before we said that is not a pretty fair piece of middle ground. Madam Chairman, we have presented information to this committee showing that in 1988, the shares, and Mr. Nelson quoted them correctly, were mid-30s for the state and the mid-40s for the oil companies. At today's oil prices, and we'll present backup on this for the committee before it concludes its hearings, the shares are about 29% for the state and about 50% for the oil companies. Now, that's not equal shares, and that's not what the oil companies were saying back then. Madam Chairman, I'd like to go through the evidence very quickly. We tried to show that this was an old issue for Alaska, that this was the same issue that Alaska faced with furs, the same issue it faced with the exploitation of its salmon resource.